Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Do you, shareholder, take this stock to have and to hold in sickness and in health? We know investing involves commitment, but how much is too much?
While we may have said to ourselves and others, we're in it for the long haul, I don't think we really tested ourselves or understood what that can mean.
We'll put some facts under the concepts of short-term and long-term investing. And if you're in mortgage trouble, you could spend hours pouring out your story to a loan officer. But old W-2s might work better.
Definitely have numbers at the ready.
A housing counselor gives some advice on mortgage modifications. Plus, there are lots of ways to get a break on your taxes that don't involve writing off shoelaces as a business expense. But you have to know where to look.
And the IRS puts barriers up, I believe, you know, for taxpayers getting some of these things.
And she works for the IRS. That and much more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Bank of America lost more than $2 billion in the fourth quarter. The brokerage it bought last year, Merrill Lynch, lost $15 billion. Citigroup lost more than $8 billion. Our coverage of fallout from the financial crisis continues as we figure out what it all means for you. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
So much for the financial supermarket, the one-stop shop where you can get all your banking services, checking, savings, brokerage, loans. Well, it is slimming down. This week, Citigroup announced a merger of its Smith Barney brokerage arm with rival Morgan Stanley. The new firm will be called Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, and it'll be the largest brokerage firm in the world, dispensing advice on a combined $1.6 trillion worth of other people's money. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch tells us what you should do if you own a few pennies in that giant pool of cash.
Morgan Stanley spokesman Jim Wiggins has this advice for clients.
I would say relax. No immediate changes are going to be required. We're going to make it as seamless as possible. And we're going to offer a world-class range of advice and services.
This, of course, is the company line. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney has already launched a publicity campaign to convince its customers to stay calm and stay put. Here's Alex Samuelson, a spokesman with Citigroup Smith Barney, the other half of this joint venture.
We have created a client letter to let them know that there's no action on their part that's required. This is exciting news. It's good for Citi. It's good for Morgan Stanley. And it'll be good for them as well.
Independent experts agree that there's no time pressure here. The joint venture has to clear regulatory hurdles, so big changes are a good 6 months away. But that doesn't mean you should sit still. Brad Hintz is an independent analyst at Sanford Bernstein and a former partner at Morgan Stanley.
It's a time to ask yourself the question, where does my loyalty lie? So in other words, do you feel like a Citibank customer, or do you feel that you're a customer of Bob Smith, you're a broker?
Hintz says most people's loyalty is to their broker, not to their brokerage firm. And he predicts a lot of turnover among brokers in the coming months.
Typically, when you have a merger, retail brokers find that their office has been shut down. What they're paid for executing a trade may change. Their boss may be fired. It's kind of troubling to see that going on, and so they may move to another firm.
This is an industry-wide issue. Other brokerages are in the midst of mergers as well. Wachovia bought A.G. Edwards last year, and Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch on January 1st.
We've shuffled the deck here. And you're going to see a lot of brokers moving back and forth.
Hintz says 70% of client assets will move with a broker that jumps ship. To head that off, brokerage firms often pay fat bonuses to financial planners who stick around. The Morgan Stanley Smith Barney joint venture will be a behemoth. It will have 20,000 financial planners in 1,000 branch offices worldwide. That could mean new products and services for current clients. Hintz recommends you call your broker and ask a few tough questions.
Here are the products that you've sold me in the past. Is there anything that's cheaper or better? Is the fee that I'm paying in terms of a separately managed account, can that fee be lowered?
Morgan Stanley's Jim Wiggins says his firm will go out of its way to keep its customers happy.
At the end, this is a relationship business. You want someone who you trust managing your money.
The good news is Morgan Stanley has nowhere to go but up. Forrester Research has ranked Morgan Stanley at or near the bottom for customer service 3 years running. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriven.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
Whether or not you use a broker, if you had any money in the markets last year, you're starting to get statements showing just how much damage the financial crisis has done to your portfolio. With all that paper money just vanished, you'd be forgiven for wondering if the entire market is, well, a Ponzi scheme. Roger Lowenstein mulled this over recently in the New York Times, and he joins us now. So explain for us how Bernie Madoff and the S&P could be one and the same.
Yeah, sure. Let's think, Tess, a little bit about how the stock market works, because, you know, we all say we're investing in these companies. We buy GE, we buy Google, and if those companies do well, we make money, right? But if you think about it, they don't send us a check just because their profits go up. Once in a while they do, maybe with dividends. But
right,
the way most of us get our reward day in, day out is because the stock goes up, and we can sell at a higher price. And what does that mean, the stock goes up? It means other people are coming in and bidding it up. So, you know, at least in the short term, even us normal investors, people who wouldn't associate ourselves with people who invested in Bernie Madoff, we're dependent on other people coming in and buying those stocks. And in an absolute sense, that's what a Ponzi scheme is.
But at least we think that we're investing in something besides air, right?
Well, we are. I mean, I think you're asking me, isn't there really a difference? And yes, there is a difference, because underneath the Ponzi scheme, as you said, there's nothing but air. In the long term, you know, when you invest in the stock market, you do own a share of a productive enterprise, and they have the power to pay dividends. And by long term, that ought to mean that you think this is a good business. It's got a good franchise. It has, you know, customer base and so on. And the point I was making is, if you're very dependent on the short term, let's just say you got to sell by next Tuesday. You're going to sell on Tuesday or Wednesday at 3:30, whatever it is. You're really on the hook for whether other people come in or not.
When we think of the short term versus the long term, I wonder if that definition has changed at all because of the economic crisis. I love your point in the article where you say, look, if you are actually watching what is going on from day to day, even month to month in this thing, you are not truly in it for the long term. What is the long term?
Well, you know, I don't think it's that the definition has changed so much. It's how we perceive it has changed because of how things are going. When markets were going up, and it was a good long time where with some fluctuations along the way, they mostly did go up. Everybody's a true blue, got religion, a long-term investor. I can withstand the downturn,
right,
yada, yada, yada. But I think what we're seeing now, not so much the definition of the term or the long-term has changed, is we're realizing what it really means to withstand the fluctuations or the down periods. This is a pretty severe down period. And so, you know, while we may have said to ourselves and others, we're in it for the long haul, I don't think we really tested ourselves or understood what that can mean.
Then it sounds like maybe we do need to change our notion of what the long term is. If we're not factoring in a market like we've seen over the last year, then maybe we're not as long-term as we think we are.
You really have to know why you're in a stock. If you're investing long-term, it's got to be money that you're not going to need in 8, 12, even 24 months. You know, if you're worried because you're going to have to pull that money out to pay college tuition or something, that money shouldn't be in the stock market, never should have been in the stock market.
It really seems, for so many of us, so hard to trust this notion of the long term after what we've been through over the last 6 months, even if we're nowhere near retirement. How do we get ourselves in the frame of mind to believe in the market again?
Well, it's, you know, just as it's very hard when things are going great it really would have been impossible to have convinced someone that of all the trauma and loss that was just around the corner. It's very hard at bottoms or at troughs to believe that things will ever get better. But, you know, Warren Buffett has said it, when people are fearful, be greedy.
Roger Lowenstein is an outside director of the Sequoia Fund and also a regular contributor to the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Great talking to you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And with me once again this week, as always, is our good friend and economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So are you a cheapskate?
No.
No?
I am not a cheapskate. No, absolutely not.
Aren't all personal finance experts supposed to be cheapskates?
Well, yes, there is a certain aura about us because we're very fond of quoting Benjamin Franklin and, you know, a penny saved is a penny earned. And yes, there is a certain image about penny pinching. Do you really need that Starbucks coffee?
Right.
Have you compounded the amount of money you'd have over the course of your lifetime if you just didn't have that Starbucks?
At least $1 million.
At least $1 million. But that's not me. I'm afraid that's just not me.
It does seem like there is a lot of talk these days about how to be more frugal.
Right.
But I wonder, what is the line between being frugal and being cheap?
I think this is one of the most important distinctions in personal finance. Now, all of us under pressure in an emergency, we're cheap because we need to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
But being cheap is not sustainable. And if you think about what is good personal finance, it's developing habits. It's like I know you have your 403B and the money is automatically put into your retirement savings account.
Right.
And we develop these good habits. And so one of the examples I love of being frugal is, you know, you go to the grocery store and you get some nice ingredients. Like you're a wonderful cook, Tess, having been over to your place. And I know you're a wonderful cook.
Oh, thank you.
But being frugal is then taking the leftovers,
yep,
and bringing them to work. That's being frugal.
Love to do that.
Love to do that. Now, you could be cheap, and you could go to the cheapest fast food place that you could find.
Mm-mm.
That's being cheap. It's not very satisfying. It's not very sustainable. You want to think about the environmental impact of your spending, the quality that you're buying, the ethical. Well, you know what? You're going to end up being frugal, and it becomes a habit, as opposed to just being cheap, where you don't think about your friends, your colleagues. It's just how little can you spend.
It sounds like you're really talking about prioritizing your spending, really making decisions on what you need and what you don't need, but not skimping?
Not skimping and taking advantage of the current environment that we're in. I mean, think about what we talk about on Marketplace Money and open the newspaper. I mean,
right,
it's one article after another about how to save money. So let's take advantage of this moment in time to really examine where you're spending, what are your priorities, and then when times are good, you're going to maintain those habits.
All right. I promise I will never call you a cheapskate again.
Thank you very much. You can call me Frugal, though.
All right. You are no longer Chris Farrell. You are Chris Frugal. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you later on in Getting Personal.
Thanks a lot.
All right, here's a situation you don't want to find yourself in. Mortgage 1 paid for the family house. Things changed. The family grew. Mortgage 2 bought a new house. Number 1 is still on the market. And now there's a third mortgage because you had to move.
Where do you squeeze the balloon to get the money you need to solve the problem?
That story and more are next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. This week, as fallout from the financial crisis continued, Congress approved the release of the second half of the bank bailout. The incoming Obama administration says $50 to $100 billion of that will go toward reducing foreclosures. Moody's reports nearly 10 million homeowners are having trouble making their mortgage payments. For some of them, it's because of an untenable adjustable rate mortgage. For some, it's a job loss that makes it impossible to keep up with those payments. And for others, it's not just one mortgage that's the problem. Tanya Ott reports from Birmingham, Alabama.
This is not a story about people who speculated in real estate and ended up in mortgage trouble. Kitty McCoy and her husband followed the American script. They got married and bought a little house. They had a couple of kids and bought a bigger house, but held on to the little house thinking it would eventually help pay for their kids' college. But the McCoy story takes a turn when, in 2006, Mr. McCoy took a job in Alabama. They put their Florida house on the market and got an offer.
And about 3 days before the closing for the sale of our house in Florida, the buyer had a heart attack.
The sale fell through. Florida's housing market crashed, and the McCoys found themselves with three homes, the two in Florida and a new one in Birmingham. They tried selling the Florida properties, but after more than a year on the market, they settled on renting them for less than the mortgage payment. So now they're in negative cash flow, triple mortgage trouble.
We're not unaccustomed to doing things the hard way, but we thought maybe we could take a little bit of a breather at this point, and it's not a lot of oxygen out there.
It's pretty stressful. I can see it in your face.
Oh, well, it's really hard to watch my husband with it. He struggles as wanting to be the provider that I think men envision themselves to be and wanting to solve all the problems and take care of it. And, you know, just every month there's something that you didn't plan for, or you didn't see on the horizon that comes up. And it's like, where do you squeeze the balloon to get the money you need to solve the problem?
The balloon that popped is college. The McCoys had to take out a student loan for their oldest son. Another son is deferring college for a year because they can't afford it. And their daughter, Summer, graduates high school in May.
They're going to do whatever they can to help me. They're not going to throw me out the door with my bags packed and go see ya. But I don't want to put them in the position that they feel like they have to do everything.
Summer McCoy says she's really nervous. She's been accepted to the University of Alabama, but her part-time job at a movie theater isn't enough to pay the tuition. There's no telling how many families are in this situation. No one keeps those numbers. But University of Alabama at Birmingham real estate expert Stephanie Rauterkus has been poring over foreclosure records. She sees a trend. The average number of mortgages per consumer has almost doubled in the last 15 years. She says in many cases, multiple mortgages means big trouble.
The whole thing fell apart, and they lost the investment property as well as the primary residence. So it's unfortunate.
Unfortunate and unhealthy. Financial planner and life coach Brady Stamps says he knows some homeowners who are so stressed out, they've developed high blood pressure, depression, and other medical problems.
Anytime you have this emotional situation where everywhere you turn, your friends are talking about it, the TV's talking about it, you try to watch a movie or a comedy to get relief, and geez, they're talking about it. You've got some people, their way to handle finances, they just choose to ignore everything.
Brady Stamp says reach out.
There's no shame in it. There's a lot of people that are in similar situations.
The McCoys have looked at refinancing their mortgages. They keep hearing about the historic low rates right now. But their debt-to-income ratio is too high, so they don't qualify, even though they say they've always had good credit and they make their payments on time. The McCoys are looking to Washington for relief. Congress hopes to pass the hotly debated economic stimulus bill next month that helps fend off foreclosures. In Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace Money. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
Tanya mentioned that the McCoys had tried to refinance. That is not easy for anyone these days because credit is still in such short supply. And if a borrower is already in trouble, they might have a better shot at trying to modify their existing mortgage. The federal government has tried to encourage banks to change loan terms for delinquent customers, but the record of success is mixed at best. So if you're looking for a loan modification, what should you do? Joining us now is Mary Ellen Nickel. She's a certified housing counselor in Atlanta. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
What are the kind of common situations where people are calling you for assistance?
Well, they're usually calling when they're past due on their mortgage, or they know they're going to be past due on their mortgage in the near future.
So what do you advise them to do in a very general sense first?
Well, I want to know if they've been in contact with their lender, if they've spoken with their lender about the situation, if they know they're going to fall behind with the mortgage in the near future, if they've reviewed the situation with the lender and let them know why they are going to be unable to make the payments.
Well, if you are hoping to modify your mortgage, as so many people are right now, what kind of checklist might you want to have in front of you when you get on the phone?
Well, you're going to want to have quite a few financial papers, things like 2 current years of your tax returns, 2 months of bank statements. You're going to want to have your W-2s or any other 1099 that you may have if you're self-employed, a list of all of your income and all of your expenses, and probably 2 months of all of the pay stubs for all the wage earners.
And how do you go about describing your situation so you can prove to them that you really have a hardship situation?
Most people are able just to recount what has happened in a way that the lender knows that it's either a temporary situation or a permanent situation.
And is this a situation where you should, prior to talking to the lender, come up with, you know, what you would like the deal to be, how much you might be able to pay, or is that something that they should talk you through?
That's why I like having a really good budget. When you know exactly what your income is each month, then you're able to know when you're talking to the lender what's going to work for you.
So you should have numbers at the ready?
Definitely have numbers at the ready.
How does that conversation go? I mean, is that, I don't know, is it like a negotiation where, you know, you give them a number you can pay, they say, well, we'd like you to try to pay this? I mean, it's, in general, are you finding that clients find this a positive experience or a negative experience, a difficult experience?
I think they're ready to agree to whatever the lender asks them to do. And in some cases, they know when they're on the phone with them that it's not going to work from a financial point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times, if I'm talking to a client who has worked with their lender already, they're calling because the agreement they made with the lender isn't going to last for much longer. And they're telling me, I agreed to do this each month or make this payment each month. Or they're telling me, I was able to make the payments for 3 months in a row, but now I'm having trouble.
Mary Ellen Nickel is a certified housing counselor at the Consumer Credit Counseling Service in Atlanta. Thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we turn around the microphone and answer your questions. And with me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello once again, Chris.
Well, hello, Tess. How's it going?
Doing all right. Doing all right. You know, you may remember last week we heard from a lot of folks about what their financial resolutions were for 2009.
Yeah.
And one of the big ones was emergency savings. Of course, that was one of mine as well. So it's a very good idea, you know, given all the job losses, other things going on in the economy. But a common question is, where do you stash those savings? And that's what Richard in Bellevue, Washington wants to know. Right now, he has his emergency funds in a 1.5% yielding savings account. But he came across the idea of corporate bonds for General Electric, and he's wondering if that might be a good place to park his money. First of all, remind us what corporate notes, corporate bonds are.
Well, these are bonds that are issued, or notes, short-term debt issued by General Electric, which is one of the premier corporations in the United States. But you are reliant on how well General Electric is doing. They're not FDIC insured. They're not insured by a credit union. So you are taking market risk.
All right. Well, he's looking at this as a short-term investment. I haven't heard any news about GE going bankrupt anytime soon.
No.
So I don't know. Is it, for a short-term investment, is it worth losing that FDIC backing for a higher rate?
You know, here's the way that I look at the world right now. You want safety, and we're talking about emergency savings right now.
Yeah.
What's wrong with 1.5%? I mean, seriously.
At least you're not losing anything, right?
You're not losing anything, and there is no risk. I mean, the only risk that exists is if we're at the, you know, the great, great, great depression, and that's pretty far out there. So if you're going to go into something like the General Electric notes, which are perfectly fine, but you're still taking some risk. So I don't call that an emergency fund. The second thing you're not doing, what is my favorite way outside of a government handshake, a government backing, what's my favorite way to keep your money safe? Diversification. So you're exposing your portfolio to one company, General Electric.
Yeah. Now,
it's a good company. But again, I would have all my government backing, including TIPS and FDIC insurance and treasury bills or notes. And then, and that's all your emergency stuff. Then your second layer is with your short-term money, well-diversified portfolio, lots of different short-term debt. And only after you've done those two things and you still got some money there, then you would look at something like General Electric notes. It's not a criticism of General Electric. It's not a negative outlook on the company. This can be a very good program. It's the environment that we're in and the need for safety.
All right. Next, we have Mike, and he is on the phone in St. Paul, Minnesota, just across town from you, Chris. And Mike originally wrote us an email. The subject line said, "What can I do?" Mike, what did you mean by that?
I was wondering what I can do to help stimulate the economy.
Well, I think maybe if you've got a lot of extra cash, make out a check to CASH and send it to Marketplace Money.
Well,
I'm just
at
kidding.
Least you didn't say Tess Figlin.
No, I wouldn't be that blatant about it. No, so it sounds like maybe you have some extra money that you'd like to invest or put elsewhere. Is that right?
Yeah, $50 to $100 a month or so.
And what kinds of options have you thought about?
Either microfinancing or making another donation somewhere.
Well, Chris, at least he's not talking about going shopping.
No, and I have a couple of thoughts. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, Tess and Mike, because I do think there is an important message to get out there, which is for most people, the most responsible thing they can do for this economy is to be responsible with their debt, save money, and don't get swayed by some of this conversation that goes on about you should be spending, going to the mall, whatever. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense.
Mike, you mentioned microfinance?
Yes.
Well, there are certainly organizations that can help you do that. In fact, we've profiled a couple of them on this show, Kiva.org. Chris, is this something that you think is a good place to put your money?
I think it's a great place to put your money. And you're putting only a little bit out there, and you're making loans to really low-income people here in the United States or around the world. And it's a good thing to do. And remember, the troubles that we're having here in the United States are also global. So whether you want to focus your money here because there's microfinance in the U.S. or whether you want to do the microfinance overseas in developing nations, whichever way you decide to go or do a mix of both, I think that's one of the smartest things people can do with a little bit of money that you lend to people who have nothing. And yet you'll get paid back most of the time. And you're not going to make a lot of money off of this. Very, very little, frankly. But you're not going to lose a lot either, and you are going to help people.
So what do you think, Mike? Is that something you'd want to take a closer look at?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Well, if you've got a question, you can give us a call anytime. We're at 877-ASK-MONEY. That's 877-275-6669. Or write us an email. You can find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back later in the show with more Getting Personal. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This week, New York's Metropolitan Opera revealed it's lost a third of its endowment. The opera's general manager told the New York Times that donations have fallen by some $10 million and senior staff are taking pay cuts. But the music of the night will go on, perhaps to provide therapy for audience members struggling with their own financial worries. Music can be a refuge in hard times. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet someone who uses it as a kind of medicine.
My name is Holly Miller. I'm 38 years old, and I'm a psychotherapist practicing music therapy.
Music therapy makes a lot of sense to use with young children because they really don't have the ability to have insight about their lives. I mean, I can't really say, hey, let's go back and talk about your childhood or what kind of patterns brought you to this sort of behavior. A lot of children I work with have autism, and a common feature of autism is difficulty with language and communication. And one of the things that we know is that language and singing occupy two different parts of the brain, although some of it overlaps, but it gives me a different inroad to help them learn language. And it's just amazingly exciting when I come week to week and I see progress, and these kids really learn how to speak using music. Music can be used with adults as well. In fact, I've had some people who have had anxiety and panic attacks that were so bad they couldn't drive the freeways. So in sessions, we've done relaxation skills, and then we've eventually paired that with a piece of music, which gives them a skill that they can use outside of the office so that we can take them from being really, really anxious on the freeways to being functional. I originally started teaching piano, flute, and voice. And I also had a degree in psychology, just because I always thought it was fascinating, and there was a little piece of me that wanted to be a brain surgeon when I was growing up. I started attracting a lot of families with special needs children, families with extraordinarily gifted children that were having emotional problems, and people started knowing that I could teach these children. People started saying to me, you know, you get more out of my child in a half-hour music lesson than their therapist does in an hour. So I really realized I was sort of in over my head at that point, and I needed more training. So I went back to school, and I became a psychotherapist. As a therapist, you really have to engage in a great deal of self-care. I exercise, I eat right, I go to the spa. I do lots and lots of things to take care of myself so that when I'm with a person who's in pain, I'm fully present. If you're a psychotherapist or a music therapist, you can make anywhere between $30,000 a year and $100,000 a year or more. I make around $85,000 a year, depending on how much I choose to work. I had a wonderful lady come in to see me one time in her 70s. And I had a moment of fear thinking, oh my gosh, I'm too young. You know, maybe she thinks I can't help her. So I just faced it straight on and I asked her, you know, is our age difference a problem for you? And she said to me, my last therapist died. I want a therapist who can be there for me and go the distance.
That was music therapist Holly Miller. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Klaus Andreasen. When someone dies, there may be some unanswered questions, and most deaths don't get more than a basic examination.
An X-ray can't cover everything. You have to actually feel it, smell it, touch it yourself.
By paying for a private autopsy. Death and, yes, taxes are coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Taxes are hard and no fun at all, but you gotta pay attention and pay up. That goes double if you are the nominee to be U.S. Treasury Secretary overseeing the Internal Revenue Service. But Timothy Geithner ran smack into the tax man this week. Turns out he failed to pay Uncle Sam some $34,000. But really, who hasn't gotten confused by all the forms and rules and the receipts? And, well, now I have a headache just thinking about it. So, apparently, did the national taxpayer advocate Nina Olson, who recently issued her annual report on the tax system and found it Tin Man-ish in its lack of heart. Ms. Olson, welcome to the program. And may I ask how long it takes you to do your taxes?
I use a software program, and it took me about a day to gather all the paper up. And then, you know, once I was in the software program, it was fairly easy. But then I wanted to check it, and that took more time. I don't trust things.
So you would be among the people who your office, says would really like the IRS to simplify things.
Yes, I definitely want the IRS to, well, it's not just the IRS. I want Congress to simplify the Internal Revenue Code, because the IRS actually has no control over what the law itself says. They do have control over how they administer the law.
I feel like I've been hearing this call for as many years as I've been doing taxes. Got to simplify it. Why doesn't it get done?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. Right now, the predominant reason is the existence of the alternative minimum tax. Now, what's happened over the years is it's pulled in more and more people because some of the parts of the calculation haven't been adjusted for inflation. And the result is that by 2010, there are going to be 33 million taxpayers that will be impacted by the alternative minimum tax.
How much of this is about kind of the rules themselves, and how much of it is the paperwork?
Well, I think that it's hard to separate out whether the rules drive the paperwork or you get into paperwork for the sake of paperwork. We've talked about complexity of the tax code before in our annual reports that we give to Congress every year. Every form that the IRS produces, we're required by law to give an estimate on how long it would take to prepare that form. And we calculated that overall, each year, it takes about 7.6 billion hours to do those forms. And then if you take a full-time worker, how many hours that worker would work in a year, it would take 3.8 million full-time workers to work those 7.65 billion hours.
You also, in your recommendations, talk about the number of tax breaks that there are out there for education and retirement. Now, everybody likes tax breaks. What's the problem with them?
When I talked to the presidential tax reform panel, I said one of the things I said to them as a general principle, choice is good, but too much choice is paralyzing and confusing. And I think that's what we've got here in both the education incentives and the retirement savings incentives. You have 11 education incentives in the code. And with the retirement plans, there are 16 such vehicles. That's just too much for people.
Let's talk a little bit about one of the other recommendations that you've made this year, which is perhaps the IRS might want to try to consider a taxpayer's financial plight before levying some sort of penalty or lien. What options do IRS agents have right now, and how could that change?
Well, the IRS has a lot of options on the table, particularly in the collection realm. We have the ability to put taxpayers into installment agreements. They also can enter into what's called an offer in compromise. And what that says is that even if the taxpayer made all the payments under an installment agreement, they still wouldn't pay the amount due. So we say, pay us what we think we could collect, whether it's immediately or over a period of years, we will forgive the rest of the debt.
So there are alternative options out there, but I don't think in general that people would characterize the IRS as a compassionate organization. I mean, are employees there empowered and trained to use these options?
That's the problem. The IRS writes rules and likes to do things a lot in an automated format and wants taxpayers to fill out forms and send in all sorts of information up front. And it becomes daunting to the taxpayer. And they give up. And so taxpayers don't avail themselves of some of these alternatives. And the IRS puts barriers up, I believe, you know, for taxpayers getting some of these things.
Nina Olson is the National Taxpayer Advocate, and if I may be so presumptuous, on behalf of the American people, thank you, and we heart you.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriven.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
It's time for more Getting Personal, and with me once again is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. Chris, let's go first to an email from Susan in Levada, Colorado. She and her husband calculate and file their taxes jointly using TurboTax. Now, the program, she says, asks for the basis of their regular and Roth IRAs. So she's wondering how important that is for that number to be accurate and how she can calculate that and somehow get it into TurboTax. Now, let me just ask you, I've never been asked for this when I'm doing my taxes. Why is that popping up if she hasn't made any withdrawals?
Here's the real issue. If you're under the limits, making the contributions to a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA, and there's just no issue, you're under the contribution limits, basis doesn't really matter.
So that would be, what was it last year, $4,000?
Yeah, $4,000. Basis becomes important if you made a non-deductible IRA. It's one of the reasons why I don't like non-deductible IRAs. So let's say you put into your IRA the $4,000, but it turns out after adjusted gross income between you and your spouse, it turns out that you could only make $3,000. That was deductible. And then the remainder $1,000 was a non-deductible IRA.
Oh, boy.
Now, basis becomes important at that point. When you start withdrawing the money, that becomes your basis, that $1,000, because you don't want to pay taxes on it again, right?
Right.
So that's where basis becomes important. So, but for most people who are doing the traditional IRA, the Roth IRA, you're figuring it out before you send off that check. You're under the limits, and then you make adjustments as the limits adjust to inflation or new legislation. You're fine. Basis is not that important.
Okay. And I do have to address one more question from her email, which is she asked whether she could estimate, parentheses, fudge the number on the 1040 filing. Does Uncle Sam really look at this number? I think our advice would be to never fudge a number on your tax filing because you never know when Uncle Sam is going to take a closer look, right?
No. And, you know, fudge, that's for the kitchen, not for the tax form.
All right. Well, next we have a call from Liza in Portland, Oregon. She says she loves listening to other people's questions on the show, but now she's got one of her own. Hi, Liza.
Hi. I don't own a car, and I'm worried that's not going to look good when I apply for a mortgage in, say, 6 or 7 years.
Huh. Okay.
I actually work in the auto industry, but I'm a cycling enthusiast and just don't need a car in my life right now. So I'm thinking about buying a car for my stepdad instead.
Then that loan would go on to your credit report, I suppose?
Yeah, I'm thinking that that might look better for my credit history and credit score.
Chris, do you have to have a car loan on your credit report? I've never heard of that.
Not at all. And you know what? I'm a big believer in not buying something you don't need.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a wonderful gesture. If it were me and you want to build up that credit history, you know, a very easy way for people who are responsible with their money is to, when you go to the grocery store, use your credit card, pay it off at the end of the month. Or something where you have not a very big bill on a regular basis, and then you pay it off at the end of the month so you're not carrying any debt. And you build up that credit history over 6-7 years, you're going to have a really good credit score.
So, Liza, you don't have to buy a car.
Okay, great. I was worried about not having an asset.
I wouldn't worry about not having an asset. What they're looking at is payment history. What they want to see is that you borrow and then you pay off the debt. They're less concerned about what it is you're borrowing. If you're taking 6-7 years and you have a good credit score and you're going in with a decent down payment and no auto loan, you're going to be a really good credit. They're going to be saying, hey, why don't you borrow from us?
Especially in 6 or 7 years when hopefully they'll actually start handing out mortgages again, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, does that answer the question for you?
Yeah, that's great.
Terrific. Well, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for questions this week. But, of course, folks can ask us for advice anytime. You can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. You can leave a message there or send us an email. You can do that through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And as well on that site, you can check out Chris's blog. He's answering questions there every weekday. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
You're welcome, Tess.
We just heard from listeners with questions. Time now for listeners with opinions about the show. Over the holidays, we aired a story about whether bribing your kids really works. In the introduction to the piece, I made a little joke about Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich. Well, John Frenzel wrote in from Saginaw, Michigan, to point out that the governor is innocent until proven guilty, and I damned him with faint humor. Duly noted. By the way, this week the Illinois House voted 117-1, and for the second time, to impeach Blagojevich. Last week we aired a piece about student loans and how you should really, really do the math before taking on a debt load that will follow you for years, if not decades. Mitchell Davis of Duluth, Minnesota, agrees.
But it seems to me that getting a four-year degree has lost its luster these days. I'm graduating from University of Wisconsin this spring, but I'm already signing up at a technical college in search of an associate's degree in a completely different field.
On the final Marketplace Money show of 2008, Chris and I reviewed how we'd done on our personal finance resolutions last year. We gave each other pats on the back for making good progress, even if we didn't do everything we promised to do. Not so fast, says Pat Alexander of Roseville, Minnesota.
Chris and Tess, I think you both were a little bit generous when you both handed each other your grades. Tess, you took the easy way out by just bumping up your 403b contributions. Chris, you can make automated donations to your favorite charities. I set up two such arrangements this December. I know I may seem harsh, but you two were way too easy on each other, so I'll do the tough love.
Okay, I promise we'll do even better this year. Speaking of which, on our very first show of 2009, we made our new resolutions, and one of Chris's is that he's going to get organized. Good reason for that, as evidenced by the photo we took of his office. Sherry Austin called in from Chicago to exclaim,
"Wow, do you do any work in this office? Oh, wait, I think I see a tiny uncluttered space on top of the desk. Good luck, and please keep us posted on your progress."
Oh, and by all means, hold our feet to the fire, people, and send us your comments. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We had a segment on taxes a few minutes ago, and now death. In 1985, autopsies were performed on 14% of the 2 million deaths that year. Because of hospital cutbacks and slimmed down insurance coverage, it's dropped to about 10%. For many families, answers and results now come at a price. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll prepared this report.
Okay, this is where we place the bodies here, and we actually use this wall here as leverage.
Former crime scene investigator Vidal Herrera walks around the cold, white-tiled room where he and his staff perform autopsies. Herrera's not at a hospital. He runs his own private autopsy company in Los Angeles. He says families come to him looking for answers.
I mean, the definition of autopsy is seen for oneself. You can never, an x-ray can't cover everything. You have to actually feel it, smell it, touch it yourself.
Most people assume that hospitals routinely perform autopsies. In fact, if the death was not suspicious or unexpected, say cancer or a heart attack, an autopsy typically won't be performed. You can pay a coroner's office to perform an autopsy. In Los Angeles, it costs more than $6,000. There's also a handful of private companies around the country that usually do the procedure for less. At Herrera's 1-800-AUTOPSY, he charges families around $3,000.
I think what they're basically looking for is honesty, an answer. What happened? Please tell me what happened.
Marcella Adams called Herrera after her mother died. Her mother was being treated for circulation problems at the hospital. She was given medication and had a terrible allergic reaction. Adams believes that contributed to her mother's death. Now she wants to sue the hospital for malpractice, and she's counting on the autopsy to be a key piece of evidence.
Look at what happened there. See?
Adams displays the graphic photos of her mother's body. The pictures show large lesions in her skin that Adams says are part of the allergic reaction.
The pictures are very revealing, and then when you add the pictures to the autopsy, to the results, it's so clear.
Autopsy pictures can be gruesome, and the process is invasive. Pathologists remove the organs and take tissue samples. Herrera says that level of detail is necessary because, like Adams, many of his clients use the results in court cases. But he says it's still the hospital that determines cause of death.
because we cannot officially give this is what the cause of death is because our doctor is not the attending physician. Many, many times we find a different cause of death, and the doctor will give his opinion.
Even if there's no dispute over cause of death, autopsies can be a source of important information. The head of Johns Hopkins University Pathology Division, Dr. Barbara Crane, says many families order autopsies not only to understand the past, but also to see into their own medical future.
For example, did a patient with cancer also have significant coronary artery disease? Were there other diseases, such as Alzheimer's disease, that might have implications for other family members in the future?
Before ordering an autopsy, Crane advises families to decide what questions they want answered. She also says it's better to talk early with family members about autopsies.
Those are very hard things to bring up. In some ways, they're easier when people aren't sick, so there's not so much emotion involved.
And there isn't much time to decide on an autopsy. It must be performed within about 72 hours of death. When it comes to private autopsies, there isn't a lot of information to go on. The National Association of Medical Examiners has a list of private autopsy providers, but it doesn't make endorsements. Families should keep in mind an autopsy may not answer all of their questions. But Crane still sees the search for answers in an autopsy, both as a necessary quality control for hospitals and a way for families to put their concerns to rest. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace Money.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we'll look at what the newly inaugurated Obama administration could mean for your personal finances. Marketplace Money producers include Stephen Hoffman, Eve Troe, and Allison Gilbert. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.